Thank you for joining me today on Geezers of Gear, episode number 193. Today's episode is brought to you by Elation Lighting. Elation is simplifying ellipsoidal lighting with the all-new, all-in-one KL Profile FC. The KL Profile FC combines everything a designer needs in one innovative lighting package, eliminating the need for additional accessories. With an integrated manual zoom range of 7 degrees to 50 degrees, the KL Profile FC requires no additional lens tubes, reducing costs and complexity. It features full-spectrum RGBMA color mixing, full blackout manual framing, and ships with a designer gobo set containing 10 high-resolution glass gobos. Shipping now, the all-in-one KL Profile FC may be the most cost-effective ellipsoidal lighting solution on the market today. Check it out at www.elationlighting.com. And also, please take time to visit coffeecult.com, that's with K's, coffeecult.com, and search for Geezer's Grind. It's a killer blend that's not too strong, but will definitely get you going in the morning. And proceeds from all sales of Geezer's Grind blend go to Roby Backstage to support people in our industry with medical and other challenges. Episode 193 it is. So hello, and thanks again for joining me here today. I appreciate you very much for taking the time to listen. And we've had a great time with all of the recent episodes, even the one that we replayed with Rain from Limelight. And you know what? I haven't checked to see which light won. I need to do that. I need to figure out which one won the March Madness of Moving Lights. And I'm wondering if it's the Megapoint again or if it's something else this time. So we'll see. Anyways, what did I want to talk about? I wanted to talk about the industry. Of course, the industry is still wild and crazy. Everyone I talk to every day, still records. Everyone's breaking records. All the sound, lighting, video manufacturers say they had their biggest year. They're having their biggest months. Everyone kind of agrees that January was slow, but February went back to sort of batshit crazy mode. It's exciting. It's an exciting time for our industry that everyone is growing as much as they are. You know me, I'm still a bit of a doomsdayer, thinking that I'm not a doomsdayer. I'm actually really, really positive about everything, but I just am a realist and I see that this can't continue forever. So I keep seeing that there's an end coming and I keep talking about it and people laugh at me for it and say, didn't you say that by now? Yeah, I get it. The whole day 91 thing as well, right? So I hope it keeps going for a long time. I hope it goes for years, but I do believe that we're going to see a slowing down in our industry. We're going to see it comes to a point again where we're sort of 2018, 2019 mode where we have kind of enough gear, but people are still looking for a little bit more or newer or upgrading or whatever. And it gets back to sort of a normal market, not one that's just kind of doubling in size all the time. Speaking about doubling in size, so I know many of you have heard or taken part in or have been subject to my own software pains. And so GearSource is a tech company. We happen to be in the lighting and sound and video world, but we are a tech company. And we did a massive software change last year where we completely switched our platform over to a new platform. We call it replatforming. And it was challenging. It's still challenging. But last Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, I'll never forget, we did a massive change, and I'll get into the sausage making here a little bit. We switched from a code base of React.js to something called Next.js. And for those of you who are geeky coders, you will say, but Next is React. And it is. It's just a lot faster, a lot better, a lot newer. And I will tell you, the change has been like somebody turned on a light switch. Like suddenly we had power that we didn't have before. It really has been a from darkness to light kind of change. And so one of the things that happened when we did our big swap last year, or replatforming last year, is we lost all of our traffic. We lost a very large percent of our traffic. And last week, beginning on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we got our traffic back. So we're not back to where we were prior to switching platforms November 9th of last year, but we're getting hella close. And so yeah, I'm in a good mood this week because the lights are back on, and it really is a good time for GearSource right now. So thank you everyone for your patience. Thank you for riding along with us. Thank you for keeping me from jumping off a bridge. And I appreciate all of our users, and I appreciate the fact that GearSource has now been in business 20 years and people continue to support us as we grow the business. So thank you. We appreciate you. So today on Geezers of Gear, I have a very cool guest, somebody I've been trying to get on for a while, not because he has my son's same name. His name is Jeremy. But because I think his product is really cool. And so Jeremy Bridge is the founder of a really great company called PK Sound, which happens to be based out of my own hometown, Calgary, Canada, as well. And I'm not going to tell you much about him or his company because I'd like him to tell you. So let's go ahead and bring Jeremy on right now. Jeremy Bridge from PK Sound. Jeremy, good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm doing excellent.
You were in sunny and warm and beautiful Calgary, Canada, right?
Maybe in a month or two, yeah. But I love the snow, so it's great for me.
Are you a skier or a snowboarder?
Snowboarder.
Ah, I think it's an age gap. You're a little bit younger than me. So people my age typically at least started in skiing and then at some point maybe switched over to snowboarding. My son's always tried to talk me into trying it, but you know, I've been skiing since I was like 8 or 9, and I just don't want to fall and get hurt and stuff.
Yeah, I hear that. I started skiing, and then I started snowboarding because I thought it was cool. But I think skiing's like come up a lot in the cool factor these days.
It has, yeah.
A lot of the kids are skiing again, you know?
Yeah, but they're doing crazy shit on skis. They're
doing crazy. You know,
they're not just pointing them downhill and turning and stuff. They're doing like snowboard stuff on skis.
They are.
And they don't really use poles, you know, which tells you that they're doing some crazy shit, right? So, yeah. No, I'm having a harder time with skiing now because, I guess, of my age and my conditioning is good. You know, I exercise all the time and stuff, but I just find that skiing is such a different tool kit that you need. And yeah, when you live in Florida, you don't practice those tools very often in the winter.
There's not a lot of snow down there to practice with, no.
Right, right. So, you know, I didn't used to have to. Like, I would just show up in Canada and ski for a few days, and I felt just fine. Now I ski a few runs, and my legs feel like they're going to fall off, so.
The first day is always like that, I think.
It's a bummer. It's a bummer getting old. So, you know, I've done a crash course learning about PK Sound. I feel like I should know everything about your company because I am from Calgary, but I've been gone 30 years and your company hasn't been around for, what is it now? Like 2000, what year did you?
Well, really.
2003, right?
Yeah. Formally, we incorporated in 2005 and it was a hobby for quite some time. And then 2009 is when we kind of say that we started doing it, you know. Good job, let's say.
Yeah, I want to go way back before that. So, you know, I read somewhere that you started, you literally were like kind of a hobbyist making speakers at 14 years old or whatever.
I think
Why?
I built my first subwoofer when I was 14 and literally with a skill saw in my friend's mom's kitchen.
So, did you just not like Long and McQuaid or whatever? You didn't want to go buy one?
We couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
We literally were trying to make a subwoofer box for my buddy's car, and he had some of his dad's old speakers from his house. And so we're like, well, these don't fit. So we just want to make a subwoofer box for his trunk. And so that's what we had.
That's awesome.
We put it together.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so like from there, it actually kind of became a thing. And so at what point, like, did it go from hobby to, hey, I might actually do a little more with this thing than just making friends subwoofer boxes?
It was a long path, actually. I moved to Calgary to take engineering.
So where were you before that?
I was in Red Deer. I was born in Red Deer, and then I lived in central Alberta, out near Rocky Mountain House, and then out near Stettler. And then when I was 22, I, like all good Alberta kids, I worked the rigs for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, then when I was 22, I decided to, that my mom was right, and she'd be telling me my whole life that I'm supposed to be an engineer. And so I was like, okay, mom, I'm old enough to understand that you are always right.
Yeah.
And so I moved to Calgary to take engineering, but with the full intention to work in oil and gas, actually.
Yeah.
And while I was in university, like every kid in university, I like to party.
Yeah.
And I also like, I also continued to have a passion for building loudspeakers. And so when I was in university to try and make some extra cash, I started a little rental company building my own loudspeakers in our, actually our basement at that point, because the garage wasn't big enough.
Yeah.
And then really, I don't know if I ever made any money. I maybe spent more money.
Yeah.
On making
typically
speakers.
Typically how those early businesses go.
But that's usually how it goes.
Yeah.
And then actually my wife was my roommate actually at that point. And she was part of this little festival in the interior of BC. And at that point it was maybe 300 people. But she'd lived there her whole life. It was called Shambhala Music Festival. And one of the stages needed sound. And she knew I had a passion in building speakers. And she's like, I'm pretty sure my, and she knew I was trying to, you know, have a little rental company. She's like, I'm pretty sure my roommate can do it. And so
there
I
it
did.
Went.
There it went. And that was actually the first like kind of real festival. Maybe it was a little bit bigger than 300, but not many, not much bigger.
When was that?
2001,
okay.
2002, somewhere in there.
You know what's weird about that story, though, because I love the story, but it's a very common story when you're talking to companies like Turbo Sound or like, you know, all of them, EAW, they all started, but it was in the 70s. It wasn't in the early 2000s. It was in the 70s, and they built loudspeakers because they had to. You know, that's just how you did it. You want a sound company, you got to build your boxes, you know, and... you're one of the very few that I've heard did that in the 2000s.
I think the difference was we wanted something different. So I had a passion, but we wanted something different. It was the beginning of electronic music in North America. You mm-hmm. know, that's where we cut our teeth. And we were a bunch of young kids and we wanted something. We wanted a different feeling, a different experience than what the current sound providers were providing. And really, honestly, at that point, it was significantly more bass heavy is what we wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so, what I was thinking when you're specific to EDM, maybe you're just looking for more bottom end.
The other thing too, is these festivals would start on Friday and then they would never stop until Monday or longer. Right. So, yeah. You know, the sound providers at that time were just like, you kids are crazy. No way. I'm going to take my nice speakers to the middle of the bush and have them play at maximum level for, you know, an entire weekend or week.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of early days for EDM festivals. You know,
it
like
was.
even, you know, again, I'm down here in South Florida, so Ultra, you know, talking early 2000s, that was early days for Ultra. And look
it
at it now.
I mean, Insomniac. Yeah.
Yeah. Ultra was just
bigger in Europe, but it was pretty small here still, right?
Yeah.
It was,
well, festivals in general, I think, were always bigger in Europe. Like
I
was talking to someone, God, I'm not going to remember the number. The number is insane. I was talking to someone in the Netherlands, and he was telling me, the number 40,000 keeps popping in my head, but he was telling me there's like 40,000 different festivals
wow.
in Netherlands every year. And I'm like, that's impossible. Like, how is that even possible? Netherlands
is
a country
very,
of 5 million people.
You know, we have a good contingent there, and we talk about it, and they are the numbers they were, I don't remember the numbers they were telling me, but it, I mean, there was very high, like you're talking.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 40,000. And I know that it sounds like a ridiculous number, but I remember it being that ridiculous. And
love their festivals.
They love their festivals. Well, and the other thing is it's not a big hotspot for tours. So, you know, not a lot of tours go through the Netherlands. So they end up having festivals instead, I guess, which is crazy. Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that Shambhala festival, and I when I was doing some research on your company and on you, I went back and looked at that, and it's very cool. Like the stage last year, I think you call it the Village or something.
Village,
yeah,
yes.
Was
my wife and I have been curated the stage. It's my hobby now, really. Honestly, it's kind of my artistic outlet, maybe.
Yeah,
but we first were doing sound for it, and then we got asked to actually be the stage directors for it.
Yeah.
And we've been doing it since 2006, I guess.
Yeah. It's
primarily her. She does all the real work now. Yeah. And I just, you know, show up and have fun often.
It looks incredible. How big is this festival, Shambhala Festival?
Well, now it's about 14,000 attendees.
Wow. And it's a one-day thing or a weekend?
No, it's a week. The core days are a weekend. The attendees are there for about a week.
Huh.
There's a bit of a ramp up and a, you know.
But they're out in the fields looking for mushrooms for the first few days.
Yeah.
And then they show up at the music part of it. There's a mushroom hunt for 3 days and then 4 days of music. Yeah. I've been to some of those fields in British Columbia.
In British Columbia?
40 years ago, but I've been to some of those fields, yeah.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty unique. The family still owns the land. The family still curates the festival.
There's no awesome
corporate sponsorship. So it still has like a very unique kind of like, I don't know.
And it must be profitable because it keeps happening.
Yeah, of course.
That's fantastic. What a great story.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. So
it was
before committing to a life of sound, you were an oil guy. You talked about that. But so that's an interesting thought too, because I looked at your sort of your bio, your history on LinkedIn, and I saw you worked as an engineer in an oil company, which cannot be a low paying job, for a couple of years. And so, you know, was it your wife or your mother that you had to call and say, "I'm not going to be an engineer in an oil company anymore. I want to go into the sound business"?
Oh, it was my mother. My wife was like all there. 100%.
Oh, really?
Walk for the ride. She's helped. She's been a founder. She is a founder in PK.
That's fantastic.
So she's been there since the beginning. But I do remember the day that I called my mom and told her I was going to quit my downtown oil and gas job to do PK full time. And no, and actually she was like, "Good for you."
Really?
I was not expecting the conversation to go that way. But she was like, "You know what? You got your engineering degree. That means that you have the freedom to pursue what you love.
Yeah,
and if anything happens, you can always go back to it. Do what you love."
I had a similar but way worse conversation with my mom when I wanted to quit school in 10th grade and go on the road with a rock band, which I ultimately did. And she had a similar answer, remarkably. You know, hey, school's not for everybody. If you don't want to be a student, I mean, and at the time I was like full on straight A grades and stuff, but I was a passionate musician. I wanted to go on the road and play music, and that's all there was to it. So yeah, moms can be very supportive. Yeah. But you know, I'm sure that was a scary thing, you know.
Of course it was scary. Yeah.
To jump out of a job like that with nothing but a secure future, you know?
At that point, you know, like, it was too much to be. PK had been growing all along the way, even while I had my oil and gas job, almost like against my will.
Yeah.
Just because of all these connections that we made, and, you know, artists started touring with our sound. And so then in 2009, we were like, okay, this is too much to be a hobby. We either just stop doing it or we really give it our all.
Yeah.
So yeah, we took the plunge and I,
that's,
you know,
really cool. You know, I've had a lot of friends ask me about that, like, you know, should I quit my job to start the company? And you did it so right. I mean, having a really, not only a good job, but an extremely stable job that pays really well and all of that stuff, having that stability while you're building a company in the background, even if you didn't expect for that company to grow bigger or anything like that, you know, it's just, it takes so much pressure off. And
yeah, for sure.
It does, also allows you to make the right decisions for the right reasons. Like, you're not just going, well, but I need the money, so I'm going to sell this guy a crappy sound system or whatever, right? Yes.
Yeah.
So PK started in 2003, but you didn't really make it a full-time thing, and you know, you didn't become the CEO of PK until really 2009, right?
Yeah, really.
So what is PK? What's PK stand for? Because it's none of your initials.
It's none of my initials. It stands for Polar Kinetic.
Of course.
It describes controlling sound through motion.
Yeah. So you always knew you were going to go that direction.
I kind of had it morphed over the years, but I always had thought that's kind of where the technology needed to go, I guess, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, based on the name, it feels like you kind of set up the company and got it going and got it to a point of stability and then dove into the big idea.
Yeah, I guess a little bit. Yeah.
The idea was always there. It just wasn't going to be executed.
It wasn't fully formed.
Yeah. So 2009, you dive in headfirst, and then I read that you opened a U.S. office, right?
We did. In 2011, we opened a U.S. office in San Francisco. Don't ask me why San Francisco. It's probably just because most of the artists that we knew were from there.
Yeah.
And we were touring quite a lot in the U.S., and at that point, we were still really primarily a rental company.
Yeah.
Both in Canada and in the U.S., we were building loudspeakers for ourselves. People started calling us and being like, hey, we saw your loudspeakers on tour, you know, could we buy them?
Yeah.
So then that's really how the manufacturing started. But yeah, the San Francisco office was to serve the U.S. tours that were going.
And most of your clientele was EDM, mostly DJs?
It was all EDM.
All EDM.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
And was that more because that was where your head was at, or was that just what your products were best suited to?
No, I mean, it's just where our network is at.
Yeah.
Really, I don't think it really, you know, you always try to build a loudspeaker so that it can serve all genres, but you grow where your network is. And we got started in electronic music, and that's where, you know, the friends that were sleeping in my bedroom all of a sudden were big touring artists, or sleeping in my basement were big touring artists. So it just grows like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that was a good time too, because these DJs, a lot of them went from, you know, making, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 a night to making 100,000 a night and flying in private jets.
That is exactly correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they became rock stars like very quickly. And
very quickly.
I have a friend down here in South Florida who was one of the people who was responsible for that shift. It's a woman named Pam DJ. Do you know Pam?
Pam Kennedy? No, I don't know Pam.
Yeah.
No.
So Pam Kennedy was one of the people, and she was working for, I believe she was working with Paul. What's Paul? EDM Paul. Older guy. Old school. Paul. Paul's.
There's lots of Pauls. I don't know.
I can't remember his last name. British guy. Anyways, she was working with him. Is it Oakenfold or something?
I mean, that is a DJ. Paul Oakenfold is a DJ, yeah.
Maybe it was him. He was one of the guys that she was working with. I don't know. She had all these famous DJs, and she helped them kind of go from being, you know, beaten down club DJs to being pop stars.
Yeah, neat.
Which was pretty cool. So, you know, I want, like, your story's interesting because I want to get into a whole bunch of things, because I want to get into your people side of things, because I love how you've assembled your company and how the importance that you place on people. But I also really want to get into the technology, and admittedly, I'm not an audio technology guy. I know enough to at least have somewhat of a conversation with you. So I'll try not to be completely stupid with my questions. But, you know, where did the idea from motorized array come from? Because I'll tell you, in sort of the after effect, it kind of seems like a, well, duh, you know, it seems like a very logical thing, Although,
I mean, if I had a dollar for every time somebody said that I had that idea, like, I mean, it's just, yes, it makes sense, right? And the idea just came from being a young engineer setting up shows and being like, this process is mad. Why has this process not been automated? It's like my couch, you know, my recliner has a motor in it because for convenience, but really the process just seemed way too manual for me. And ultimately I was like, why is it that every day I go to a different venue, which is a different shape and size.
Yeah.
But the loudspeakers that I have to use are fixed.
Right.
You know, you can generally set them up, but in a manual nature to try and cover shapes. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense. Why can't we have a speaker? I always had the idea, why can't we have a speaker that can change like a light, right? You can focus a light.
Yeah.
You can widen it.
Well, and we've got away from manually focusing lights, you know, in
a long time,
yeah, a long
right?
time ago, 30 years ago. So
I was like, well, can't we just motorize it? And I'm sure, and I know lots of people, I've had talked to people from Meyer, from lots of other companies. They're like, I had this idea a long time ago.
Yeah.
But at some point, an idea becomes able to be reality because, you know, different technologies converge.
Yeah.
You know, the actuators have become a lot more robust and a lot less expensive because of other industries like automotive, like solar.
Yeah.
You know, so you get other industries driving down the cost of these parts. They can become more readily available. Embedded systems are, you know, they're not like voodoo magic anymore, right? You know, putting together an embedded system is known technology. So, and then computer software, same kind of thing. So all the tools were there. They just needed to be put together. And
I pitched
the idea. We had literally at that point, I was the engineering team at PK myself.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do all that myself. So I pitched the idea to the National Research Council of Canada and they got behind it.
And interesting. I want to go backwards just a little bit.
Yeah.
There's probably people listening to this going, what the hell are they talking about? So what you did basically, and I'm sure you're going to tell me I'm wrong here, but what you did really was you took a line array system and a line array, from what my basic understanding, a line array, there's sort of a mathematical equation as to how a line array is positioned, how many boxes are in the array, and the direction of those boxes based on the room that you're putting sound into or the space that you're putting sound into. And so far, is that relatively accurate?
It's relatively accurate.
Okay. Yeah, and so every time that condition changes, you have to then go unbolt these arrays that are in some sort of a curved array. You have to unbolt them and change the angles of that curve to better suit that space.
Yes.
Accurate so far?
Accurate.
And so what you did is you found a way that you can... presumably, there's a piece of software involved that reads the room and that says, here's the angles that this thing needs, both vertical and horizontal angles that this thing needs, and whoop, and all of a sudden, the system is in those positions, and you don't have to deal with all of the time-consuming and heavy work of moving things around on the hardware that you're hanging the system from, right?
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much have it, yeah?
Yeah. See, I'm not that stupid. I thought I would never get through that with you. I thought there was no way I was going to get through that one.
One of the big things, too, about the line array, though, when the line array took over from the old trapezoidal arrays, you know, like the big old wall of sound, like trapezoidal arrays, the whole industry kind of lost sight of the horizontal, the ability to direct or change. Because line arrays, pretty much all of them, there's a couple exceptions that are manual. They have control manual in the vertical plane.
Yeah.
But they're fixed in the horizontal plane.
Right. Interesting. So you just have to add more boxes basically to change.
Boxes. Yeah, what? Boxes beside them or you know, angles between them.
Interesting. So this is something that is positioned, I'm assuming, when there's no audience and
that's correct.
Yeah. It's not something that you're going to need to change because the conditions changed or whatever.
There's not. I mean, there's been some use cases that the people have talked about, like, you know, when a performer goes out onto the thrust to be able, feedback is a real problem when the performer on the thrust, right? So the ability to pull the sound field off the thrust, that maybe small things like that, but generally it's a setup and tuning type configuration.
So from a hardware standpoint, is this system in a sense safer because you're not changing that hardware every time you put it into a new facility or whatever?
It's safer because when you set it up, you don't have people's fingers with little tiny links in between arrays that weigh, you know, thousands of pounds. So in the setup sense, it is quite a bit safer for the people that are setting it up, I would say. I've been that person with my finger in the
I
wrong
know way
spot,
too many people.
you know? And when you can just fly the system straight and then articulate it afterwards, you don't have that problem anymore.
And so what is the process? So everything comes out of the truck, it gets hung and the rig goes up and then what happens?
Well, okay, our process, I guess the software that we use is called Dynamics, and it's called that because I've been a proponent that the process shouldn't have to necessarily be rigid. The prescribed process is you get the drawing of the venue, you put it into our software, you simulate the venue and the loudspeakers virtually, then you go to the show, you bring the loudspeakers out of the truck, and you set them up as per plan. And then the system flies straight, you connect it to the software. You articulate or you change the robotics to fit your prediction, and then you fine-tune from there by changing robotics. I mean, maybe, but the reality of the situation for anybody that's been in production, everyone knows that that never goes. Production never goes the way you plan
Of
exactly.
course, yeah.
You know, there's all, okay, the barricade is 10 feet forward or 10 feet back, or the rigging points, the lighting guys, I'm pointing at you. Put the truss line where the speakers are supposed to go. You know, like there's so many things that happen in the real world that if you use a conventional system, you have to go back to the planning step, replan, and then redeploy or rehang the sound system. But with ours, you essentially can, once the system's been flown, you can adjust to those, like, you know, conceptually. Actually, not conceptually, this has happened. You know, you don't sell as many tickets as you thought that you were going to, so you're not going to open the 270 section or something like that, for example. So with our system, you simply open the software, you adjust the robotics in the system to have less horizontal coverage in that instance, and you go with the show, and you have less reflection because of it, because you're not shooting sound at empty seats or something like
So
that.
it's not something where, like what I was envisioning was something where there's just microphones placed out in the room and it just automatically, is sending signals out and getting them back and adjusting itself, like fine-tuning itself.
Not yet.
Not yet. We working on
Conceptually, I think that we have the building
that?
blocks to go to something like that. I have a couple ideas with respect to that. It's always like it's a fine line between how much, you know, the technician wants to have control versus how much you want to give them. And you always want to give them the best starting point and then let them take their
Right, of
craft
course,
to the next level, right?
That makes so much sense. So the very first time that you hung this rig, it had to be pretty exciting. Like you had to be standing there just going, "Whoa," as it's moving, as everything's like going from being hung straight to curving into an array.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of years.
It didn't just suddenly happen, I guess.
Just didn't suddenly happen. It was a lot of years building up to that because we were developing, you know, kind of like a greenfield in our industry technology. So there were lots of bumps and bruises along the way. There was points where I didn't think it was ever going to happen ever. And yeah, it was an amazing feeling when it all came together and it worked.
But so before you had a motorized array, you had just normal line arrays, right?
Yep.
And is it basically the same box? Like, are the components the same and there's just actuators built into
it
now?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the technology of the line array is generally the same. I mean, we have our own twist and our own flavor, but the reality of the situation is that all of the top manufacturers are, you know, Ella Acoustics, D&B, us, we are all using the same transducers from the same companies. So
the boxes are powered?
Our boxes are powered, which makes us a little different, more like Meyer.
Yeah.
But because our platform requires each loudspeaker to be essentially smart to a degree, the powered solution is okay. Even before that, I've always thought that a powered speaker makes more sense for a rental company specifically, because as the owner of a rental company, I wanted to be able to deploy my investment however I want it. If I want to send three speakers here or two here or one here or seven here, then that's what I can do. I'm not constrained to my amplifier setups and configuration, you know?
Yeah. You don't have to go out and reconfigure a bunch of racks or whatever.
Yeah, no, you don't. Just use your inventory how you need.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to make sense from a cabling standpoint and stuff too. Like it always was something that I thought made a huge amount of sense when I started seeing companies putting out powered boxes, but I think you just have two sides of that one, right? Like there's always going to be two sides of
that one, right?
You know, that's no different in the lighting business, how, you know, one side always thinks it should be this way. The other side thinks it should be a different way. I don't know. You're ever going to win or lose that argument. So is it like the obvious question, I guess, it's got to be wildly more expensive than the competitors that you've mentioned.
There's more technology in the loudspeakers for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not wildly more expensive.
Yeah.
Especially recently. So in the beginning, of course, the first time you take the kick at the can costs you more. You're developing new technology.
Yeah.
And Trinity is more expensive. But recently we've actually been able to get it a lot. Like I'm taught a lot more competitive.
Yeah.
We poured a ton. I mean, there was two kind of trains of thought during the pandemic. You either sit down and you just hold on and see what happens. And there's the other train where you just pour more into it. Cause
that was me too.
Believe that the other side is going to come. And I took the latter approach. And we invested a lot in R&D over the pandemic because it was a great time to do that.
Yeah.
But it allowed us to kind of like re-envision and take another pass at the technology right from the ground up with everything we had learned over the last 10 years. And so we were actually able to reduce the cost by half.
Wow.
In our latest T8 line array, which we're building kind of 200 beta boxes this year. And then the plan is we'll actually, you know, go to formal production and marketing, that type of stuff,
so
in 2024.
Eight, is that the transducer?
8-inch, yes. Yeah. So a smaller line array. We have large format, then we have a 10-inch, then we have 8-inch now.
Yeah. Really cool. And it's actually manufactured in Calgary?
It's actually manufactured in Calgary. Yep.
Interesting.
We have a workshop. We have full assembly. I mean, we have lots of third party contractors.
Yeah.
OEMs that build, you know, cast parts or stuff like that for us. Grills. But all the wood cabinets are built here right below me.
Amazing.
And all the final assembly QC.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of the cooler things I read about your company was that it's manufactured in Calgary, you know, my hometown where I was born and raised. And it's exciting, you know. I love seeing, like, Calgary's not a big hub of audio technology, let's just say, you know?
It's not the touring mecca of the world, no.
Not the touring mecca of the world, no. Which, you know, can complicate things, but it also can, you know, I'm sure the being able to hire people in Calgary is a lot easier than Los Angeles or New York or a lot of other places that may be more of a touring hotspot or a audio hotspot or whatever you want to call it, even technology people.
There's pluses and minuses. So, yeah. You know, like on specific roles, obviously specific, you know, experience, we have to bring those people here.
Yeah.
Because maybe have a base of it. But on the other side of it, you know, the majority of this town is oil and gas.
Yeah.
And people are kind of tired of that industry. And anybody who loves music, you know, if you end up at PK and you love music, I think you're going to stay here for quite a long time.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I want to get into that a little bit too. And unless you think we've missed something on the technology side, like, so what is your latest greatest? You talked about the T8.
T8 would be the latest greatest, I would say.
Yeah. So that's sort of being launched right now. You said you're building
some kind of in beta. So we're putting it out with our trusted users, distributors, that kind of stuff over the next, because I really like to try to have a product really ready.
Yeah.
When it goes to market. So that's, I believe,
quite a concept. Maybe you could teach some of the lighting manufacturers that beta test it inside, not in the market. How's that?
It's so hard, you know, because there are always financial pressures. You always want to have your latest, greatest box into the market. But it pays to take time to do it right.
We're also in a techie industry. Everybody loves a new thing. You know, they love a new wrinkle. They love a new feature. They love a whatever. Oh, you've got that. When can I have them? Can I put them on AC/DC? I got AC/DC coming up next month. Can I have them? So
the world in general is different. You know, software can be developed and iterated and released so quickly as compared to a product.
Yeah.
Our world is used to the newest, greatest feature right now over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do that with products.
Well, and guess what? That's getting a lot quicker now too because of all the latest AI stuff and, we're always talking about that. Like I talk to lighting designers all the time, you know, when do you think your console is going to program itself? And everyone agrees it's not very far out. You know, that's coming quick.
The latest GPT scores I was reading, GPT-4, are insane.
Unreal. I mean, I've been writing blog posts with it. I'm not too proud to admit. You know, I've been writing all kinds of things with it and just trying things and just going, whoa, you know. But I mean, within the next year, you're going to be able to create your own website in a few minutes, you know, by just saying, make me a website that does this and this and this and this and this. And boom, there it is, which is crazy.
It's going to be an interesting ride for sure.
It is. Do you, just to stick with hardware here for a second, do you work closely with any of the console manufacturers? Like, are there any features from your products that are built into Digico consoles or something? Or...
Not yet. We part of the platform that we just spent the past number of years through COVID and now developing though is an AVB digital audio capability on the Milan. So all of our newer products with our newest amplifier platform will be Milan ready. So that will move us into the area of kind of like collaboration, I would say, with the console menu. I think it's a pretty cool idea to have, be able to, especially for like, say, a corporate application where you're just going to bring two speakers in your favorite console and then you just want to control those loudspeakers from your console. I think that's a great application.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So I want to talk about your people concept because, you know, and again, I might be wrong. I read it somewhere that you're employee owned.
Yeah, I certainly don't own all the company.
Interesting.
And purposefully, actually, one of my first jobs, my first job out of engineering school, I worked for a company called Spartan Controls. And it was where I got the concept. It was my first job, professional job. And everybody at that company was so invested and people had been there for 20, 30 years. And then I went to work at the next company, and it was a revolving door. And so the difference with Spartan Controls was that it was employee owned. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this is such a great concept. And I've never wanted to be, I'm not here because I'm trying to make $1 billion. If I wanted $1 billion, I should have just stayed in oil and gas. I'm here because I want to create something that lasts and that makes an impact on the world. So financial motivations are secondary for me. And that leads to my leadership style and the ownership of the company. I'm much more interested in having a group of people that have a total vision, aligned vision, because we are all owners, and you know, we all get to share in the reward of building a successful company that changes the world. So since the inception of the company, it's the whole concept has been to be employee-owned.
So, you know, and you can tell me at what point I get to be asking, you know, secret things that you don't want to tell me about. But what's that look like? Like, so, you know, you bring in a new engineer and you tell him, okay, by the way, we're employee-owned. Do you just hand him a stock package, right? When he walks in the door, or is it vested over a period of time? Or
so when a new employee starts, there's a 3-year vesting period.
Okay.
The employee can start to earn, and typically it comes through part of our comp. Well, I mean, if you step back, I guess everybody's compensation structure in the entire organization is the same as mine.
Oh.
So we have milestones that are laid out from today till 10 years from now. And every time we hit a milestone, we get a raise, we get shares, and the whole company does.
That's really cool.
So, I mean, if I'm going to preach alignment, then we really should probably be aligned, and I shouldn't be on some magical fairy compensation structure that my guys in the wood shop aren't.
Yeah.
So when you start at PK, you get presented with a compensation plan, and you can start to accrue equity, I guess, or contribution towards that plan. And then once you've been here for 3 years, then you vest and you become a shareholder.
And so isn't there a challenge to that when someone leaves and goes to work for your competitor?
And yeah, they own a piece of your company? There's pluses and minuses.
Yeah.
We have the option, of course, in our ESPP to part ways amicably, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, that's such a cool model. I love it. I mean, it's like you're literally kind of putting your money where your mouth is.
I mean, here's the thing. If I hire somebody and I want them to treat the customer or our partner like I would treat them, like an owner, then isn't the easiest way and then makes the most sense for them to be an owner too? Yeah. I always use the example of my dad's toolbox. When I was 14, my dad gave me a truck. And he, you know, he had a pile of tools and he's like, you can fix this truck up. And I borrowed the tools and I lost them all. They weren't my tools, right? I didn't care. He's, you know, he's my dad. I love him, but the tools. As I was older in life, I bought my own tools.
Yeah.
My toolbox is immaculate. I know where every tool is. If I lose it, I know. And it's because they're mine and because
that's a great analogy. So doesn't your cap table just look insane though? Like if you go to bring in a new investor or something, don't they go, whoa, you have like 112 owners, you know, what's going on here?
That's the way. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reality picture. Of the situation. It's not that complex, and I've actually never had, we've done it. We did a Series A race in 2018. And I would say everybody, I mean, I want people to be involved that share my values, right?
Yeah.
So if that doesn't work, then that's probably not a match business-wise.
Yeah. I really love that. That's fantastic. And I'm guessing, you know, you don't really have an attrition problem. Like you said, revolving door problem.
No, I mean, that's one of the nice benefits too, right? When you're an owner, you care about the company, you want to stick around for a long time.
Yeah.
And every employee owner knows the cost of new hires or replacing people is extremely high.
Yeah.
When you get the good people, you want to keep them around. It makes the whole company stronger. It makes it grow faster. It makes it, you know.
Right, of course. Is there like a voting process or anything? Like when, let's say the company wants to go a certain direction, like do you almost hold a board meeting with all your investors and say, you know, we want to do this. We want everybody to vote on it. Not that you have to, but.
We have the typical corporate structure where the directors guide the, day-to-day operations of the business throughout the year. And then each year we have an annual general meeting. And at that point, major considerations can be brought up or new directors can be appointed, that kind of stuff. So yeah, there's your typical voting process like you would have in even maybe in the public company, although we're not public and
don't want to. Very cool. So now your business has gone beyond EDM. And you're actually touring with music acts as well, I would assume, or live entertainers or however, bands versus EDM.
Yep.
And any unique or different challenges to that, or are you finding it harder to break into that market than EDM perhaps? I don't know.
I think it's always harder to break into markets that you didn't build your core in, right?
Yeah.
And it's not because of the technology. It's because of your network.
Yeah.
Network is everything. It's who you know.
Yeah.
And so that when you go into another market, you have to build that network from the ground up, or you have to have a partner that takes you into that network. So on the technology side, honestly, no, I don't think there's no real challenges I could say. Like the nice thing about EDM is it's by far the hardest on a loudspeaker that there is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you go to other things, it's actually kind of easier on the loudspeaker.
Yeah.
And the technical implementation is similar, right? Regardless of the genre of music.
Yeah.
It's more about the crew and the stuff on stage. You know, obviously a DJ show on stage is completely different than a live act.
Yeah. So when did you transition from just building stuff for yourself to actually selling products outside of PK Sound?
Okay, so
on a scale, like
it was a slow process. Obviously, we started as a rental company that just kind of built loudspeakers for us. And then, as I mentioned, people just started calling because the loudspeakers were on tour and they'd be like, I love this for my club. I'd love this for a production company. And so we started to grow them. And I think my vision for the company was manufacturing and technology. But our core was in rentals. And so right up till the pandemic, actually, we had still a rental division. But the pandemic made that choice for us. Well, no, we made the choice, but we were heading that direction.
Yeah.
I wanted us to be, that's where we were making our long-term investments. When you got a successful portion of your business, it's hard to just turn it off.
It is. Yeah.
We started to move some of our customers to our loudspeaker customers. And then the pandemic hit and we lost all the revenue in just like everybody else a week.
Yeah.
And we licked our wounds and complained about it for, a month or two. And then I was like, guys, okay, we're no more.
Yeah.
We are now a global manufacturer, period, only. All of our rental customers, when they come back, because the pandemic will end, will go to our customers.
Again, another really brave decision to make, just like leaving an oil company to go form a sound company full time. But
I wasn't brave enough to make it until it was removed from me, though.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's hard. I mean, the margins are so much better on doing a show than on selling a box. And so, that money's nice, I'm sure. But at the end of the day, if you want to be a serious sound company, sound manufacturing company, I think it's obviously the right decision, even though there's some logic to having a sound company on the side where you can test new technology and stuff, right?
That was always a nice part of it for sure.
Yeah.
The beta process kind of happened in-house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's a lot to be said for doing something, one thing really well, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, we grew loudspeaker revenue 4 times through the, 2, 3 years, two, 3 years of the pandemic
Yeah.
because we were hyper focused.
Good for you. Yeah. Well, and let's face it, the other companies left a big hole in the market too when they couldn't ship for a year or whatever, you know. I know somebody who sent $4 million or whatever to D&B 18 months ago, and I think they just got their, I don't know if it was a J rig or what it was, but at the end of 2022. And there's a lot of stories like that out there, and everybody suffered from some supply chain issues, and you probably have some yourselves. You buy some of the same electronics and same components and stuff, but yeah, there's certainly room, you know, when a couple of
Certainly.
companies are that dominant, there's always room to go in there. And especially, you know, again, you have the added wrinkle that you've got technology nobody else has. That's patented too, right? You're protected. There's
Yep, for
IP.
sure. Yep,
Yeah.
multiple cons. Yep.
That's really, really cool. I'm very excited for you. I think I'm a bit of an idiot for not even knowing you guys existed until I started talking with Andrew a couple months ago. Actually, you know what? Gil Hopkins, who we both know really well, sent me an email and said, "You got to check these guys out. It's really cool." And I was blown away right away. I said, "Man, I love it. Can you connect me to them? I want to get the founder on my podcast and talk to him about the company." And it took a couple months to lock you down. You're a busy guy. But
I'll confess, I don't love interviews. I'm not the super best at them, but I'm definitely much more at home in the engineering lab.
yeah. Well, I'm trying to talk to you in Calgarian, you know, as much as I can.
Yeah,
So,
I appreciate that.
yeah. So, are you a Flames fan?
Oh, wow. I'm
It's
not a hockey fan.
challenging. Oh, you're not a hockey
Can you
fan?
believe a Canadian fan that doesn't love hockey?
What the heck is going on? Please tell me it's not baseball.
No, actually, I'm not a sports fan, just in
Oh,
general,
okay.
other than snowboarding and mountain biking.
Good for
I
you.
played, I was your typical Canadian kid. I played hockey, collected cards, and everything. And when I was the first strike, if you remember,
Yeah,
the
of
first
course.
hockey strike
Yep.
happened when I was just like, I don't know, probably maybe 10 or 12 or something like
Yeah.
that. And my dad was a welder, could barely afford where we lived. And I was like, what is going on? I idolize these guys and they're on strike. It didn't make sense. I didn't understand the dynamic at that
Yeah.
age. Didn't understand the owner player dynamic like I do now.
Yeah.
But it didn't. And so
You just
that
shut it
just
down.
severed my
That's
relationship with
it.
hockey.
Yeah. You got a little bit pissed off and said, "I'm
I got
leaving."
pissed off and I went
Good
somewhere
for
else.
you. Good for you. Take your money with you. Yeah, good for you. Well, I was always a diehard Flame fan, and it's hard to watch what they've done this year. And it's crazy because I don't know if you know, but the Flames and the Florida Panthers made a fairly massive trade before this season, and it sort of worked out for the Panthers in that the guy who came here, Tkachuk, is like our all-time leading scorer and just had an unbelievable year. But the team went from being the President's Trophy winner, which is the top of the entire league, to not making the playoffs this year. And Calgary, who was like second or third best overall the previous year, they lost Tkachuk and got our top guy, which was Huberdeau, and he's just laid an egg in Calgary. And now Calgary looks like they're not going to make the playoffs either. So the trade went horribly for both teams.
Oh,
It took
that's
them
horrible.
both the wrong direction.
That's horrible.
And so yeah, it's a bummer. And they're my two teams. So, you know, I'm going into the playoffs with no teams. I'm bummed.
Ah,
So I guess I'll just work.
because
Yeah.
that's all I do.
Yeah. Well, Jeremy, I appreciate very much you taking the time to do this. It's been very enlightening, and you know, who knew I could like an audio guy and appreciate an audio guy? You know, I'm a lighting guy myself,
We
so
didn't get in the fight.
no, we didn't get in a
We're
fight.
good.
We didn't
I
nobody.
even used the lighting reference,
Yeah, you
right?
did. You did. Yeah. No, it's all good. No, I appreciate it, and I intend at some point when I'm up in Calgary this year, I'm gonna check in with you and see if you've got some time, and I'll come buy you lunch or something and check out your place.
Yeah, please come. I would love to give you a tour. Like I said, loudspeakers are best enjoyed in person. So
I don't even need to hear it. I just want to see the thing move. You know, that for me is just going to blow me away, because it's still like I was just talking to somebody about your company this morning, and I directed him to your website, and I went to your homepage to grab the link and send it to him. And I watched the little video again, and I just get goosebumps every time I see it. Every time I see that array, like, you know, taking shape, I just go, wow, you know, this is just, you know, I love innovation. And, you know, to me in the audio business, the last innovation this big was, you know, maybe even as far back as like digital consoles, you know, when we went from analog to digital consoles. It's huge. It's massive. So I'm sure competitors are going, God damn it. You know, do you plan to license the technology? Probably not.
You know, a lot of people have asked me this, and I've never had, I guess I've always said no. But maybe that's a mistake. I don't know.
Who knows?
I love building loudspeakers. I want our loudspeakers across the world.
Yeah. I understand. And you have such an advantage right now. So it's very cool. Well, thank
Somebody
you, my friend.
We had the real conversation. I'm sure I would talk
to
him. But,
yeah.
You know,
money talks.
but it does come back to passion, and that's why I'm here. Right.
So of course. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you, and I look forward to meeting you in person, and thanks for doing this.
Marcel, I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.
My sweet.